Well, I want to thank all of the organizers. You've been incredibly warm and hospitable and funny and kind. It's really a tremendous delight to be here. I'm glad to know there's tea, because I arrived not that long ago from the United States, and I'm a little sleepy, actually, at this moment. But you'll see a sudden change in my energy when I hit New York time. It would be great. And your announcement was great. It reminded me, many years ago, my friend, my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, and I were on a train here, going from London to Newton Abbott, I guess, and somewhere along the train ride came the announcement over the PA system, if you require a cream tea, please come to the cafe car, something like that. Joseph and I looked at each other and said something like, under what circumstances would one require? But here we are. And I'm very, very happy to be in England, to be in London. I was just saying that from the moment I landed, really, I was like filled with delight. I was at the airport and I saw, you know, outgoing flights to Johannesburg and Hong Kong and all these places. And for some reason, I just thought, whoa. You know, this is an incredible place to be, and I think it stood me in good stead going through immigration, which I knew would end well, but you know, sometimes it's a little bit difficult. And the man said, have you been here before? And I was still filled with my rapture, and I said, oh yeah, but it's been way too long, something like that, so that pleased him. Welcome to London. Here I am. It is a really wonderful thing for me to be able to gather with like-minded people and to be with all of you for this day, or 2 days, those of you who are coming back tomorrow. And even though the day or the weekend is about loving kindness, is centering on that value, I usually begin with some basic fundamentals of meditation practice. How many of you are new to meditation practice altogether? Okay. And, you know, we'll go through some of that. The day is usually divided between sitting meditation, walking meditation. And walking meditation doesn't necessarily mean walking. If you have a physical issue or for whatever reason you're not going to be walking, it doesn't matter. It really is about an extension of the practice away from a formal sitting context. So it might mean sitting outside. It might mean actually, literally, drinking a cup of tea, but doing a meditative process during that tea drinking. And then there's often a lot of time for discussion, questions and answers and so on, as well as my speaking in terms of laying out kind of a context for the different practices. This is quite a room, really. It's a beautiful room with amazing energy and very interesting decor. So maybe I'll start with, and we'll have breaks also, when you can just go to the bathroom or get out of the room and stretch and so on. But I'll start with a short description of what I see as the fundamentals of meditation practice, and then maybe we'll just take a short break and have our first sitting here together. I often think of meditation practice as a kind of skills training. I went to India, as many of you may know, when I was 18. I was a college student, and I was going to a college that had an independent study program. So if you created a project that the administration liked and approved of, you could go anywhere in the world, theoretically for a year, and then come back and do your final year of sort of a cross-cultural study. So I had taken, in one of those circumstances, one of those seeming happenstance events, when I was a sophomore in college, I needed to do a philosophy course, and so I chose an Asian philosophy course. I think probably because it was on Tuesdays or Thursdays, and it turned out to be a course in Buddhism, which completely changed my life for two very striking reasons. One was what seemed to me to be the Buddha's very unashamed, unafraid acknowledgement of the suffering in life. Like many people, I'd come from a family where there was a great deal of suffering and discord and loss and change. And as for many people, it was a family system where this was never ever spoken about. And so I didn't really know what to do with all of those terrible feelings roiling inside of me. And yet here was the Buddha saying right out loud what I had never heard said in that way. There's suffering in life. And then the next thing, which was, of course, extremely important, was the Buddha's very unashamed, unafraid opening to everybody, saying no one is left out of the possibility of doing something about that suffering. Perhaps not the external circumstances, but all of those ways we are afraid and lost in sort of mindless desire or greed. The ways in which we feel so alone and so cut off. The ways in which we fight and we fight without really an enemy. And so many ways in which we suffer. And the Buddha said there are tools to do something about that. And it's not just for the special people or the lucky people or people who are who have a certain talent. Anybody can deal with and transform those tendencies that cause so much pain and unhappiness for us. And he said, there are tools. We just have to use them. So I put together those two things, the possibility of the independent study project and my newfound, very strong desire to learn what those tools were and what they might mean for me. And I created an independent study project and asked to go to India so I could study Buddhist meditation, and the university accepted it. Off I went. So it took me a while to find just the kind of situation I was looking for, because I was not interested in the philosophy. I certainly wasn't interested in the dogma. I didn't want to call myself a Buddhist. I didn't want to reject anything else. I wanted those things. I wanted to see what they might mean for me. So when I finally found really the right situation, a good situation for me, one of the first things I heard in establishing the context of my practice was very important for me, which was the Buddha did not teach Buddhism. The Buddha taught a way of life. And so it really wasn't a question of identifying with a creed or a dogma or rejecting anything else. It was a question of some very practical tools of mindfulness, of awareness, and so on. I had another teacher, a man named Manindra, who a little bit later on said something very important for me. When he looked at me and he said, the Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddha's problem, and then you solve yours. And I know I get the feeling I'm not conveying that quite as he said it. It was really extraordinarily kind. Because I felt almost as though it was the first time in my life that somebody was looking at me as though to say, you can solve your problem. You can solve the problem of the confusion and the unhappiness that has brought you here to India to begin with. You can do that. So that's the skills training, is picking up some pragmatic tools, trying them out, seeing what the effect might be. I see meditation practice in general as a skills training in three ways. One is concentration. Most of us would say we're fairly scattered. We are distracted. And it's not just in meditation, we notice that. We sit down to think something through, to work through a dilemma, and before we know it, we are gone. We're just gone. So the immediate effect is a feeling of being quite distracted, unsettled, uncentered. You can almost say like the larger effect is a feeling of being fragmented, as though our lives were quite compartmentalized, without a sense of unification or integration. It's the way many of us might say we feel like we're one person at work and a different person at home. Or, I was teaching in New York City not that long ago, and somebody said something that I have often said as a kind of joke, but she actually said it. She said, I'm filled with loving kindness and compassion for all beings everywhere as long as I'm alone. As long as we are with others, but quite uneasy about being alone. So our lives can be very fragmented in that way. So the skill, the developing skill of concentration is like bringing our energy together, bringing our attention together, having the development of some steadfastness, some steadiness in our attention, the ability to be more centered. No matter what is going on. So within the Buddhist tradition, that skill of concentration, the development of concentration, is considered, first of all, the path to, you could say, power, because it's quite empowering to take what is really a huge amount of energy that is quite wasted and bringing it together so that it is available to us. And it's also considered a path of healing. Because even like in that movement of my hands, just bringing the energy together and bringing the energy together, it's a movement toward wholeness, toward that sense of integration. So that's the first great skill, no matter what technique or method or style that we're actually developing. The second is the quality of mindfulness. It's mindful awareness, which of course is a word that is much more commonly used. These days, for a number of reasons, and can mean many different things. One definition of mindfulness that I like is a quality of awareness where we are connected to what's happening in the moment without the intrusion of bias. You know, where we can basically see what's actually going on, pretty much. So much of the time, our reaction to something is so fast that we actually think the incident or the experience and the reaction are one thing. But really, there's some space in there. You know, very often we react with holding on, with grabbing, with wanting to keep something from changing. Or we react with fear or pushing away or anger. Or we react if it's a sort of boring, ordinary experience of kind of numbing out or going to sleep. There are lots of different kind of reactions we have. And the process of mindfulness is not saying we will never react, but we'll try to see what's actually going on. So for example, we may have a painful feeling in our bodies, and it feels one way as it is right now. But most commonly, if it begins, we fall forward into the future. What's it going to feel like in half an hour? What's it going to feel like in an hour? What's it going to feel like tomorrow? So not only are we experiencing what's happening right now, but we have what's happening right now plus all that anticipated pain, which of course doesn't make anything any easier. Or maybe historically we've been afraid of a certain emotion, and that very emotion pops up. So we shut down. We try to pretend it's not there. It's something else. Or we get so confused about the distinction between the experience and the reaction that we tend to have the feeling that the reaction is permanent, solid, inevitable, universal, all beings at all times must feel precisely that feeling? So, for example, some time ago, I was in New York City, and I was going to meet a friend in a cafe, and she was really, really late. So I took out my cell phone, which is virtually never on, and I turned it on, I left it on the table, and I waited and waited and waited and waited, and I kept looking at it, and it didn't ring. And finally she showed up, and I said, "Where were you?" And she said, "I called you 4 times, and you never answered." And that's when I realized that my cell phone wasn't ringing. So I spent about 3 hours, like, trying to get it to ring, to no avail. So that night I was teaching a class, and I was teaching with a friend, and somewhere in the middle of his talk, someone's cell phone rang. So it was my turn to talk, just after him. I brought that up, and I said, you know, there was the sound of the cell phone ringing. One might well imagine that the person whose cell phone it was felt kind of humiliated. Other people might have felt annoyed. I was sitting there feeling really envious. There's cell phone ring. I can't get my cell phone to ring. And not only that, you know, they have a really good ringtone. They have a better ringtone than I have when I had a ringtone. I don't even have a ringtone, you know, so one sound. So many different reactions, right? That really this world is fluid, there's movement, there's possibility. We don't always have to react with annoyance. But the truth is, we don't hardly even know we're annoyed when it starts. My other favorite example of lack of mindfulness is, you know, times when we're getting very irritated and angry and we don't even really realize it. And we go off to the computer and we write out the email and we press send. And maybe 2 hours later, we go, whoops. I guess that was, there was a little hostility in that message. Maybe I'm not going to get what I want. And then, as you probably know on certain servers, if the recipient of your hostile, nasty email is using the same server, you can press this magic button called unsend. If they haven't read it, they never have to know it existed. And so, you know, you go running off to your computer and you look to see if they've read it. Of course, they've always read it. Can't unsend it. It's not a small thing to know what we're feeling when we're feeling it, when it begins. And to have a more balanced relationship of interest, of investigation, so that we're neither subsumed by everything that comes up, nor are we closed down and rejected. So mindfulness is a quality of awareness that can connect to what's happening in the moment without being defined by it, overcome by it, or without pushing it away, rejecting it, or hating ourselves for its arising. So sometimes you say mindfulness is like a place in the middle. We're not denying what's going on at all. We're quite connected to it, but in a different way. Not lost in it, not pushing it away. So it's a skill. And we practice mindfulness not just because it's a better, more wholesome, more healed way of relating to everything that comes up in our experience, but because it's a platform for insight. If we're struggling against all these different things that are arising, we're not going to learn a lot. And also, if we're overcome by all of these different emotions that come and go, and sensations that come and go, we're not going to learn a lot. So we're creating a platform for really seeing deeply into our experience. That's the second great skill of mindfulness. And the third itself is loving kindness or compassion, which certainly we'll talk about throughout these days. But I'll just say briefly that I think it's quite interesting even to think of loving kindness or compassion as a skill. Many times I've been with different scientists, neuroscientists, researchers, as they present their findings to the Dalai Lama, say. And very often, especially if they've done research into some kind of compassion meditation, you know, they describe the process, they describe the findings, and then there's a summation which includes, and from these findings, one can actually begin to think of compassion as a skill. And I always sit there and think, well, duh, you know? Of course it's a skill, but it's not a commonly held belief, apparently, because it seems to warrant, like, an exclamation point, you know? And I've often pondered, you know, why is it that it seems strange to us that compassion is a skill? You know, do we think it's a gift? And that you either have it or you don't? Do we think that it's just an emotional reaction with no way to kind of set the stage for it? To open to its possibility, things like that. I don't know exactly, but it interests me. And yet, certainly from the Buddhist point of view, compassion is a skill. It's a skill of awareness, of opening, of attention, and that's really what we'll devote these days to. I think compassion and loving kindness are like the hidden ingredients in any methodology, whether they're ever spoken of or not, whether it's ever articulated or not. Because I don't think you can actually do a meditation practice without deepening the quality of loving kindness and compassion. So, for example, the first practice we'll do together after the break is just the fundamental foundational exercise of sitting down and feeling your breath. And that actually was the very first meditation technique I'd ever learned. And in fact, I was quite disappointed, you know. When I first heard that instruction, I thought, feel my breath. I came all the way to India. Here's a magical, mysterious, esoteric, supernatural process that's going to clear away all my suffering and make me happy. And then I thought, well, how hard can this be? And I believe I thought something like, okay, what would it be? What would it likely be? 800 breaths, 900 breaths before my mind starts to wander? And to my absolute astonishment, it was like two. Gone. Way gone. Or half a breath. Sometimes four in a really good run. And this is what most of us discover. Our minds jump to the past, and jump to the future, and to judgment, to speculation. So there comes a moment in the process where we need to recognize we've been distracted. It's like, whoops, quite some time since I last felt a breath. We need to let go and we need to begin again. And that's the moment of compassion. It's not that easy to let go and begin again. To find that two breaths later, you have to do it again. You have to do it again. The deepening of the process is a constant one of letting go and starting over, and letting go and starting over. That's really the art form of meditation, is the ability to begin again. Because in most cases, it's not going to be 700 breaths or 800 breaths before you find your attention has wandered. It may be more than two. It may not be more than two. Doesn't matter, because we're cultivating a tremendous amount of compassion if we can just let go and begin again. It's compassion for ourselves, which becomes the platform for compassion for others. It's not that easy, because what do we tend to do when we realize it's been quite some time since we last felt a breath? We think, she's got to ring the bell soon, you know. Maybe I'll just go back and think that through so I never have to think about it again. Or even much more likely, we start berating ourselves. I can't believe I'm thinking again. I'm such an idiot. No one else in the room is thinking. They're all sitting here in bliss. Why am I thinking? They're not thinking. Or maybe they are thinking. But if they are thinking, they're thinking beautiful thoughts. They're thinking spiritual thoughts. I'm the one who's thinking about the place with the tea. Where did he say the place with the tea? I don't know. Why am I thinking that? I'll be told. I don't have to think about it. I'm so stupid. I'm so bad. You know, it's like, all of which, first of all, you know, we've been distracted already, and now we've just added an immense amount more time to the period of the distraction, and it's quite demoralizing. You know, we're just drained, we're exhausted by that. Instead, we consciously work to have some compassion for ourselves, to let go and begin again, and let go and begin again. And that will really be a theme, you know, throughout these days together. Okay, so that's what we're going to do here. That's what we do in the meditation process. And so we'll start with that particular exercise, which I'll guide you through. We'll do various kinds of practice, including certainly quite formal loving kindness practice, which will work on these same principles. Okay, so why don't we just take a break and come back and have a sitting. Can we do it in 10 minutes? Okay.